welcome to the Soccer Coaching Podcast, brought to you in association with our friends at Soccer Coach Weekly, reflecting our shared ambition to help coaches have the most effective, enjoyable and successful coaching journey for them and their players. We hope you enjoyed this episode and thanks for listening. Hi Sam, welcome to the Soccer Coaching Podcast. How are you?
Good, thanks Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Completely my pleasure again. We had a brief chat before we hit the recall button. You're in the UK, you're Midlands-y kind of way based?
Yeah, based in Nottingham currently.
Okay, and I guess that suits with work and stuff, does it?
Yeah, with obviously the life of a coach, you're always kind of travelling anyway. But for now, yeah, Nottingham's my base.
Yeah, have cones, we'll travel.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thanks for this. Look, again, like everybody comes on the podcast, we know how busy you are outside of, you're just doing the normal job. And this, I'm looking forward to it, Sam, because it's a bit different. We spend a lot of time talking about the X's and O's on this podcast and covering some coaching bits and stuff. And we'll do a bit of that with you for sure. But kind of the main theme is around a book you put out there, I think maybe a few months back now, at least maybe not even last year, which is a bit different to what we usually cover. So I'm looking forward to getting some more details around that. I was hoping you can remember what you've read, what you wrote down. But before we do, just a bit about yourself, your background and what you currently do.
Sure. So at the minute, I'm a YDP coach at Aston Villa in their academy, predominantly with the under-14s. And then alongside that, I do a lot of tactical analysis and analytical content for mainly for a company called The Coach's Voice, who are based in London in the UK, who have a real broad range of coach education content, plus the more generic kind of analysis around games and players, as well as coaching specific detail as part of a subscription site. So there's two main parts of that role, and then they also do other kind of analytical stuff for more recently the Premier League have asked me to do a lot of kind of content around there. They have various coach education programs running for different clubs and specifically coaches in different roles, so I combine kind of all those plus do my own kind of self-employed analysis on top of that, so I keep myself busy to say the least. Prior to Villa, I've worked at Derby County, Burton Albion, and then whilst I was at university, I had a placement with Cardiff City. So I've worked for a few clubs in kind of an academy setting at all different ages, mainly as a coaching role, but I've done a little bit of analysis, certainly when I was, again, kind of learning the trade through university. I studied in Cardiff. I think it's now called the University of South Wales. It kind of changed its name. Whilst I was there, I did 2 degrees. I did a foundation degree in football coaching and performance for 2 years. And then I did a top-up Bachelor of Science in sports coaching and performance whilst doing kind of coaching qualifications as well. I did my UEFA B with the Welsh FA. Then did a bit of kind of coaching analysis with Cardiff before jumping into full-time employment, which in and around university years and then post-university was based in America. So I did a lot at Disney in Florida. And then moved out there permanently for a few years in New York, New Jersey, working in kind of their EDP programs before then coming back to the UK. And as I say, working for different clubs dotted around, mainly the Midlands area, being based in Nottingham. That's been my background so far.
You travelled a fair bit there then, Sam.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's part of the turf, right? And being open to offers and being flexible and everything like that. How do you find kind of taking on new challenges and relocating? Do you enjoy that side to it or is it one of those things that's a bit of just you have to put up with it, it's part of the job?
Yeah, I guess you have to be open-minded to want to have a kind of football coaching career. There's only X amount of jobs going. So it's not like, I don't know, for example, if you wanted to be a plumber, for example, in any city or state or village or wherever, there's lots of opportunities. But generally in football, if you want to be a coach, if you pick a city, there's probably one, maybe two clubs in that city. So you are quite restricted and limited to where you can go. And I've always kind of liked the challenge of moving and living in different places. I always had the aim to live and work in the States specifically. So I used to go there a lot when I was younger on holiday and stuff, and particularly New York, even now to this day, is still one of my favourite places in the world. There's just something about that place. I don't know what it is, but it's just got something about it. And to do that for a few years was fantastic. And then, as I say, again, kind of applying for different roles and meeting different people in the game. And sometimes you feel that I've been a little bit lucky in some instances where an opportunity falls in my lap that's not kind of not the official process where it's placed out and you apply and all that. So I think some things I've been had people get in touch with me to approach me that way. And then I've also gone the other route where a job comes up. So like the one at Villa now, a job came up officially. I applied and went through the formal route. So I've had different routes into different places. But I guess, yeah, just being flexible and that's something I think I'll still have with my life. Not to say that I'm not enjoying where I am and I'm not settled, because I love what I do and where I am. But I do think there's always an element of being open-minded in football.
And how much, Sam, because obviously you've done a few clubs in the UK, you've done two different areas in the States. How much does football change depending on where you're located? I mean, is there a big difference in coaching at Villa compared to Derby or Cardiff, or in like Florida compared to Jersey or New York? Is it different?
Oh, absolutely. It really is. Even something as simple as, so my move from Derby to Villa is about an hour in the UK. And the kind of player profiles and personalities off the pitch that I found that I work with at Derby to Villa has been totally different. So not only do obviously the clubs operate in terms of a kind of syllabus and a style of play and everything is quite different in terms of the way clubs work, but the actual players themselves are very different. Their mannerisms are different. Some are a bit more kind of street smart and older for the years, and some are more kind of more traditional kids, what I would say is what a 14-year-old would normally be. So there's been a bit of a change in adapting there. And then again, the difference between the UK and the USA is, again, very, very different. In the States, I've often found, just as a kind of stereotype, there's a lot more emotion out there with people in general. I don't know whether that's just a British thing where we're just not as emotional as
you don't want to see my under eights games on Sunday, Sam. They're very emotional, I promise you.
But they do tend to literally wear their emotions, I think, a lot clearer, even just kind of away from the game, just as people and as and that's obviously has strengths and has potential drawbacks, but that kind of there's a lot more emotion management in the States, I found. And then kind of tied in with that, again, most of my coaching in the UK has been in the academy level, where the players are generally very, very good. So there's that side of things to deal with. And I've always said that one of my biggest kind of strengths that's helped me across my career is that I've worked at kind of every age from like 5, 6 to 18. And I've done mainly boys, but I've done a few girls teams as well over the years. And that kind of difference of levels and ages and stages has been massive for me for finding what I'm good at and what I need to improve at in terms of my delivery. And it just makes you a better coach, because although there's differences as the ages and stages change, there's also a lot of similarities that you need to coach anybody. And I think that's been really important.
And do you prefer the coaching or the analysis?
I would probably say I would never not want to be on the grass. I don't think I could do like zero coaching, but the analysis side has got more and more a part of both my life and my career. And it's something that it's like, for me, it's the yin to the yang, where both complement one another, because I personally think the way the game's going, which I'm sure we'll touch on it later, is the way technology is. And you have to be able to be reasonable in some areas and elements of analysis to be a good coach, and then vice versa. I don't think you can be an analyst now and not kind of have the first clue about coaching, because ultimately you have to translate the two and you have to have that relationship between the two. So, yeah, to probably have a bit of a cop-out answer, both are really important, but I guess there's something about being on the grass that is very addictive.
It's tempting to ask you lots of questions around the analysis side of what you do, but I worry if we do that, we're probably going down a rabbit hole that will take us the next hour or so to go through. So I'm going to try and avoid doing it if I can. Maybe we'll come up when we talk about the book a bit later on, or we do another episode maybe at a later date around that side of what you do with your career. But right now, we'll try and move on. With your coaching more specifically, I think it's always good to know, especially I'd like to know anyway, just kind of how might you describe your own coaching philosophy, just the kind of your approach to coaching, specifically to watch one of your sessions, whether it be, you know, a foundation under 8 or an under 14s, or anything really, boys, girls, what would be some of the consistent ways in which you'd always approach your coaching when you're doing a session?
It's interesting. We've had a lot about this in kind of last few years, once I've gone through some courses, and particularly the A-license that I went through kind of just before COVID. And a lot of it was obviously the technical, tactical detail and getting the elite side of things. But a lot of it was, what's your your like coaching brand, if you like. What are you, what are you about? And I think when it came down to it, I kind of had three main kind of points, where the first one was honesty, where everything that I would do will be my honest opinion, whether it's good, bad, indifferent, whatever it is. I think that honest kind of two-way feedback is so important, particularly when you're working with younger players, and having that flexibility and range to be honest that if they're doing something great, you obviously need to highlight that, and that can get the rewards from the positive side of things. But also, you know, the negative side of things, if it's a work rate issue or if it's an ability thing, being honest about potential issues and drawbacks in players' games, but then the way you go about it is obviously a skill in itself. But I've always kind of pride myself on that I will always give my opinion, and however players take it and how other staff take it and stuff, and how I deliver it myself is very, very important. But I don't think I could ever be dishonest in what I do. So that was a very, very big foundation of my coaching. The next one would be making everything as personalised as you can. And particularly with young players, that you can get, as we've discussed already, lots of players are very different. Even players in the same team, in the same club, you can have some quiet ones, some like really loud, almost lunatic ones. You can have everything in between. So everything that I do, as much as possible, will be personalised, both on and off the pitch, for them, because particularly working with young players, you're not really creating teams, you're helping individuals get better within the team context. So trying to, as I say, make everything personalised to individuals, I think you get better buy-in from players anyway by doing that. So it becomes more of a two-way relationship. But it's almost like your duty of care, that's your, whether you're volunteer, level one, level two, BA, pro, whatever, your duty of care is to work with your players that you've got in that moment and ideally help them get better and enjoy being there. And if you can make that as personalised for them and make that as special for them as you can, then for me, you've done most of the job already of a coach. And then the last one I kind of highlighted would have been just the detail. So again, the environments I've worked in mainly are kind of academy settings and more professional environments, for with the end goal of working and playing in professional and semi-professional game. So that detail element has been really important for me. But then that can translate to when I've worked at, when I was in the States and I did some kind of travel teams, we're seeing what the level of players we've got, what detail do they need to kick on it and get better and enjoy the game more. And that ties in, I think, with the personalised approach as well, getting the right detail for the right player at the right time. Because you are a teacher, you're there to teach elements of the game, you're there to help players improve. So obviously you've got to know it inside out, and you've got to know and keep in touch with modern trends, keep in touch with what other people are doing. And with the amount of technology around nowadays, as a coach, you've probably not got that much of an excuse to, you know, listen to a podcast like this and put it on in the car when you're driving home and listen to what other people are doing. And the phrase, the best coaches are best thieves, that came up very early on in my coaching career. And that's always stuck with me. So try and take as much as you can from everybody, positive or negative. But I think you can take something positive from every single person you meet. I really do believe that, both as a coach and I guess as a human being, you can take something positive from everybody and try and implement that either in the detail, in my honesty, or in the personalised approach for coaching.
I love this question, Sam, because I think it really gives insight as to the person who's talking, you know. And I think maybe a few years ago, if you asked about philosophy, you'd kind of get some kind of scripted answer that was a little bit kind of just, I'm not saying wishy-washy, but maybe just more kind of like a coach course oriented, where now you kind of get coaches basically giving off 3, 4, 5 words, and it really gives you a picture of what they're like and their approach. I think they're brilliant, Sam, honesty, personalised and detail. And I guess the thing about these is they're all interlinked, right? You can't really have one without the other two there. You can't give detail unless you're going to make it personal, and you can't get personal without being honest, right? Because otherwise it won't work. You're wasting everyone's time. So brilliant. What influenced your coaching then, and what influences philosophy from your background? Now you've obviously gone through the formal education with regards to the degrees and the masters and the coaching courses. Yeah. Is that your influence, or is there other things that have come into play there as well?
Yeah, I guess the kind of formal education route has had a massive implement in on my life and me as a coach and me as a person as well. That whole, you know, leaving home at 18 and going to live on your own, fend for yourself in, I wouldn't say the real world, because when I was at university, it's not the real world as such as it is kind of post-university when you've actually got bills to pay and you've got...
If only it was a real world, eh?
Oh, getting a couple of grand from the government to go, blow how you see fit, yeah. I think that formal route has definitely had a huge input, and it was more, I guess it was more the people in that time in my life. So my lecturers, I was really fortunate. I say this to everybody, that I don't think I could have handpicked a better selection of lecturers that I had. And none of them now work at the university anymore. They've all gone on to done and go to different environments in different places. So it was someone called David Goff, who has moved to the States. He's done a lot for women's national teams. Done for stuff for the universities out in the States. Dave Adams, who's been at first team level kind of Everton, done some stuff with Middlesbrough, is now I believe he's now the tech guard director of the whole Welsh FA. Mark Neville, who is now with the FA, the English FA, as a coach educator. Those kind of three were amazing for me at that time, and they've all, the level that they operate at now just shows how kind of good they were. And then to have them all at the same time, it was kind of like mind-blowing and really stretching you as an individual on that process to learn as a coach. And then, again, it was just a coincidence with the way the world was that Dick Bate was the academy manager at Cardiff when I was at university. I think he kind of joined when I was already there, and then he stayed throughout my university years and whilst I was at the placement in Cardiff. So literally any time you could have 5 minutes with him was like a three-hour course, or it was... To this day, he's the best kind of coach, educator, or person that I would say if you could pick somebody's brain, he would be the name that even over. I've never met someone like Klopp or Guardiola, but I would rather sit in with Dick Bate than a Pep or a Klopp. And I don't kind of use those words lightly, obviously, because those two particularly are best of the best, certainly at the minute. And obviously, it's unfortunate that Dick's no longer with us, because he really was. Like he, for me, he's still the aim of what I aspire to be as a coach, both on and off the pitch. He's like my measuring stick, where you'd love to say one day, oh, I think I could put myself in that same breath as him. But because he coached for like 50, 40 years, you know, I've been coaching for 10 years-ish, something like that, 10, 11 years maybe. So hopefully I've still got a long career to go and a long way to go in terms of years. But I still do question myself a lot and thinking, Jesus, I'm nowhere near like what he was, and just his ability to get his thoughts from his head and plant it in the thought of the players or in another members of staff was almost like some kind of psychic element or
whatever. Jedi powers.
A Jedi would probably be the perfect way to describe him. He was brilliant, and so at those university years, all those kind of three or four individuals I just named there, and all at the same time. It was like the best grounding you could ever have to want to develop a career in football.
Yeah.
It really was. And I'm really fortunate to say, obviously, I had all of them at the same time. And every now and then, Mark Neville was at Cardiff. He was actually a tutor on my A licence. So on the day one of my A licence, when I walked in, I saw him and I thought, well, he did my UEFA B, so it's quite fitting that he's on my UEFA A, and we had a good catch up. I spoke to Goffey about the book. And yeah, so every now and then I try and keep in touch, because they were huge to not just help me go through the educational route, the formality of it, but getting the skills to build a career. And then since then, again, I've worked with so many talented members of staff at all the clubs I've worked at, not just coaches, but analysts, people who work in recruitment, the strength and conditioning staff, medical physios, heads of coaching. I've worked with some unbelievable people that, as I say, it comes back to what we said earlier, you can take at least one positive from everyone you meet. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people that I've literally stole so much from that I feel that's brilliant. I'm going to nick that. And again, I guess it's a consequence of working in some really fantastic clubs that they're going to hire fantastic staff, aren't they? So, yeah, I've been quite fortunate that it's more the people have probably had the big influence on my coaching.
I think some part of that is also, you know, if you put yourself out there and you've got the right personality and a good fit, these things can kind of attract each other, can't they? You know, so it maybe there's a little bit of luck and fortune in there, but also there's a bit about your own personality. I'm sure that's maybe just for those relationships and build those relationships with these kind of mentors, I guess, that have guided you. So thank you for sharing that. I want to talk about your book, but just one more question before we do, and it's maybe an unfair question, so if you can't answer, don't worry, but I want to get a final sense about you as a coach. If you had to go and put on a session this afternoon, last minute, and you've got to jump in there and do something, and there was kind of no rules, there was no curriculum, there was just right, here's Sam and here's a group of players, I won't even give you an age, have you kind of got a favorite kind of go-to session that you'd pull out to deliver, just, you know, that this will do the job to kind of fill the next maybe 60 or 90 minutes?
Yeah, I saw this question, I thought, oh, that's I love that one, that's brilliant. Yeah, like for me, I would always predominantly say I'm stronger in possession than out of possession, so that comes in partly because of, that's probably the thing I've studied the most in terms of as a coach and analyst learning. And it's also my favourite part of me delivering. If I had the choice, I would much rather do an in than out of possession session. However, something that I've been quite conscious about, certainly since I kind of developed more onto the UEFA B, UEFA A side, was not isolating kind of moments of the game as black and white, because the game is so fluid and crazy at times that when is that cut off between in and out and stuff. So if I did an in-possession session, I would always focus on kind of the transition when we lost it as much as the in-possession. So I would kind of pair it like that. And then the out-of-possession again would be, we're doing an out-of-possession session, but we're also going to look at how we might counter-attack from that. So I'll try and, as a topic, if you like, it would be, I guess in black and white, it would be an in-possession session, but there would be other elements of moments of the game with that. And with that, I'd kind of focus on just dominating the ball and ways to do that and being brave to have the ball in as many scenarios as you can. That's a huge part of me in terms of what I believe in, that every player should be able to dominate the ball, whether you're a keeper, whether you're a forward, whether you're centre-back, whatever. And I try and tie it in with that love of the game through players, because my argument is no matter what age, stage or ability players come to a training session, the first thing they'll do is look for the bag of footballs.
Yeah.
They won't go, right, let's put some cones out and let's do 20-yard runs. They'll try and get the ball. More often than not, they'll try and shoot, but more often than not, again, they'll get a football out and either do passing, keep up as whatever. So trying to maintain that love for the ball, I use that as one of my big coaching points, that there's only one ball. There's in the big format, there's 22 players. Chances are only one player's on it at once. And ideally, I'd like that to be on our team and not their team. So if you've not got it yourself, your teammate's got it. So that has been a big part of kind of what I believe in. But in terms of, I guess, a session layout, I do like a lot of opposed practices where there's decisions to make. And again, giving that players the chance to make decisions. And again, going back to the personalised point, for me, if it's they're making decisions, not me, then the session is already more personalised because they're the ones making the decisions. That's not to say I don't do unopposed possession. I did a training session last night where the first 15 minutes were unopposed, so it has its value. But where possible, I'll go opposed as much as I can. Even if the ability is quite low, then I'll just tailor my numbers to still get the opposed session out of it. And then it might be something like, say we split the group in half and it'll be two smaller possession activities. Then they'd come together to make one bigger one and try and tie in the small elements to the medium elements, and then adding in either a phase of play or a small side of the game with, generally I'll always try and put one condition rule on it to maintain some certain behaviours. It's very rare that I will just say play, because I think, again, you've got a duty for the players that you're there to help them improve. And there's nothing wrong with saying just play, but again, making it personalised for players. If it's just play, then are you giving certain conditions for individuals then? That will be my kind of question mark. So there's always some kind of conditional, obviously I hate the word rule, but it technically is a rule. And I would always have the flexibility to do that where it's if you can, not you must. So if you can score first time, it's worth three, not you must score three. So again, you're getting that personalised element of it, but you're being flexible enough to manage the game as what's going on in front of you, and give them the freedom to make decisions and play the real game. Because I've been guilty in the past where I'm putting so many rules and conditions on it that they have to do. Yeah, it's getting out what I want from a coaching perspective, but the game isn't real. The players probably aren't enjoying it. and nobody's really benefiting other than probably my ego, because I'm thinking, oh, my session looks great tonight. We're playing out from the back and the amount of times we've done it. But realistically, when it comes to Sunday and we're getting pressed, they're not going to do that.
Yeah.
So that two-way relationship of having the try but not you have to, I think is important for any activities. But yeah, I guess that would be a session structure if you could put it as generic one.
Perfect. Thanks, Sam. Appreciate that. It's really good. I appreciate how hard it is to answer that without kind of any more context than that. You did a brilliant job. Thank you so much. Yeah. And I totally echo the point about, I think that's coach evolution as well, where I've done sessions or would have done maybe a year or so ago where I'd put a condition in and it would be the condition, you know, and I think it still looks like it's fun, but you're taking away choices where actually I've learned now to actually maybe just put a condition in where you reward a certain outcome slightly more than a normal outcome. So yeah, any goal counts, but a one touch finish is worth 10 points rather than one. So you can try and score 10 goals on your own or as a team, but actually if you can just get one touch goal, it's going to be the same with 10. So the players kind of embrace that and it doesn't become a false economy where they're trying to force things that aren't on and stuff. So yeah, brilliant. Right, now on to the main point in the podcast, which is your book. When did the book come out, Sam?
So officially it came out October last year.
Okay.
Due to I'm going to reel off a load of excuses for you here. So literally due to obviously COVID, Brexit, lorry driver shortages, the Suez Canal getting blocked.
It's all about the timing, Sam.
there's one more. I always forget one more. There was a fifth one that it basically got pushed back and delayed. So it mainly focuses on, obviously, it's titled Football in a Pandemic. So the main focus was during the bulk of the pandemic when the Premier League football kind of, it stopped and then it came back without the crowd. And that's the main focus on what it was like when it wasn't normal. And it was literally being played in a pandemic. And the aim always was to release it as close to the end of the season as we can. Kind of tied in with the Euros period where, I guess from a marketing perspective, football's in the news every day because they're playing in a pandemic, there's not real crowds, and then the Euros around the corner and the whole, you know, England get to a final and it's massive in the news. But as I say, loads of different issues, pushed it back to October, so we got it over the line finally. In hindsight, obviously, if we'd have known it would be an October release, what I would have loved to have done is get a bit more data and a bit more research on, I guess, some of the post-COVID effects on the game. Yeah. Because as time goes along, people are now understanding more and more about what COVID is and the potential benefits and drawbacks of playing with no crowd and COVID as in, it was an injury as well. People often forget that it's players were out, not injured, but they had COVID. So that is an injury in theory that players are missing matches from that never existed before.
Yeah.
So it came out officially October, as I say, and then the stock kind of built up for in and around Christmas. So glad to say it's out on the shelves now and out online. And it's, as I say, yeah, it focuses mainly on the pandemic. And it's called Football in a Pandemic. And a few people have pointed out, hopefully it should be called Football in the Pandemic, that we don't have another one.
Yeah, it's not the most optimistic title, is it? It's a good title. Yeah. But it's number one. You can get version two out in a couple of years' time, maybe. Yeah. Let's hope not, in all respect.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah. So it's Football Coaching the Pandemic, an insight into the strategies and tactics used during the 2020 and 2021 Premier League season. Was it something that you were passionate about studying and just got interested in, or did someone ask you to write this? Because, I mean, obviously, your data analysis side and what you do, you're into this stuff 100%, but it must have been quite fascinating looking at it. But was it initiated by your own interest, or was it someone else?
It was a bit of both, really. So the idea for doing a book was basically, so I was on furlough for a lot, not being able to coach. And it was a case of, as soon as the schools were shut in the UK, then me as a job, you're not going to get to work because the schools are shut, so you can't work with children. So it was a case of, I've got, for the first time ever, I've got a lot more time to, although I was doing analysis as well as, I had a lot more time in my schedule to do my own stuff, which I've always done. I've got like my own collection of analysis that I keep for myself. I've got my stuff that I do paid employment for, whether it's for a club or a company or whatever. And then I've got stuff that I kind of share on the socials, which I'm going to touch on a little bit later. But so I've always kind of had distinct categories of work. And I've always felt that I want to create some kind of project that I can really stick my teeth into. And I've actually got the time to do it now, but I want it to be something that's not kind of linked to me as a coach or my delivery or the club that I'm working at in that moment in time. It's not linked to a company. It's not linked to anything. It's just my own research, my own work, and it's my body of kind of study that I can then share. And we've discussed with various people, kind of the book was the way to go through it. And then I got in touch with a publisher early on, and it just kind of snowballed quite quickly from initially potentially being more of a like a data study and potentially linked with a university, to then going, you know what, probably the best route is stick with the publisher route, make it an official book. Kind of the intro of the book focuses on the COVID element and how it affected the game, but then tie it into more of a, not necessarily a coaching manual, but more tech detail from the game element. So you're getting the pandemic and the COVID side of things, but then you're also linking that into what's been affected on the pitch, so you can kind of hit different areas. And as I said, without the furlough opportunity, this wouldn't have happened because I wouldn't have had the time to.
Sure. Yeah.
Not just sit through and watch kind of all the teams that are kind of focused on sitting through all their footage and stuff, but then obviously doing the research on the data and the injuries and the numerical side of things, I wouldn't have had the time to do. So that, being honest, that was the main driving factor, that I had the time to do it, and I've always wanted to come up with some project that I can release some way, and for this particular one, a book was the best way for that.
And did you have in mind kind of the things you wanted to look at before you started? Because I would imagine as an analyst, you know, there's a lot you could look at, right? Or maybe almost too much stuff. So did you think, right, actually I want to look at, I don't know, maybe it's goals or subs, or I don't know what, did you kind of think, I want to narrow it down a little bit my focus, otherwise I'm going to be too broad here. I've not seen the book. I want to see it, someone, I will get it, but I kind of think, where would you start with that? Did you have to kind of rein yourself in a little bit to be focused on a few things, or did you kind of look at everything and see what was most interesting?
Yeah, I guess obviously the COVID element was as it was, and as the season was kind of progressing, certain things started to influence what I was looking at. So obviously, the fact that there's no fans is something that straight away I had to address. The fact that the games were seemingly every day, weren't they, at really random kickoff times. So in terms of players' recovery and that side of things, that was something I had to address. The fact that the referees having no home fans and away fans, and that potential bias, looking at that. So there's lots of element of kind of COVID brought its own elements to the book that I thought, well, I've got to not just include that, but I've got to introduce the book as those elements, because they're the most important thing. Although it's only the first chapter is all the COVID impacts, and then each chapter goes into a specific team or tactical idea. But I felt that I had to start with that, and that was my starting point, because this is such a unique season that, as we've said, hopefully it doesn't happen again. Yeah. But you would imagine that even if it does happen again, you'd imagine that the world now is so much better prepared for something like that, that even if it does get a repeat, then it would probably look quite different. And there was such an element of unknown in so many different areas, like obviously away from football, but then in the sport itself as well, that presented itself quite clearly. But then in terms of the tactical stuff, yeah, I guess I could have picked absolutely anything and everything from any team. And I was fortunate that the publishers were great, Pitch Publishing. They were brilliant in terms of helping me structure a book first and foremost, and then kind of word count limits, different chapter sizes, how to structure it, start, middle, end, and where to potentially divert ideas. So they were great in that, which then helped me prioritise certain things. But my main thing was to try and include things that were potentially unique in that season that hadn't been seen before in the game that were tied to COVID, plus some kind of new ideas maybe in the game that were almost irrespective of COVID. It was just the way some teams decided to play, that were kind of unique in and around that period of time. So anything kind of new that I saw, I tried to prioritise. And a big thing for me was to try and cover. So anytime I see a lot of analytical projects, one of my not criticisms, but one of my observations is generally it's the top couple of teams get analysed and they're the focus. And obviously that's great, because if they're the best, you want to know what the best are doing. But I tried to make sure that the teams at the top were covered. There were some teams in the middle that had bits of detail, and then there were some teams that were kind of bottom half that were also covered in their own respect and what they did well, and trying to make sure that there's no right or wrong way, just breaking down into what teams do well, respective for them. So there's an element of all 20 teams in that season were covered in one chapter in terms of how they attacked and scored goals and how they created, but then some other teams who weren't as high. such as a Leeds or a Brighton or a Villa, they had a lot of input on them purely because they do some stuff well that is different to what Man City can do well because they're different teams.
Yeah.
So that was something that I was quite conscious of, well, of getting in to make it a bit more, say, generic, but a bit more approachable for coaches, because ultimately if I did a load on Pep or Klopp or Man United or whoever, the majority of people, myself included, reading it would go, well, I haven't got the best players. I've got players that might have to defend a bit differently. So trying to highlight what might be good practice from people you might not get associated it as much, if you like.
And we want to encourage people to go and actually get the book. So we want to give all the details away here. But would you be happy to share kind of some of the key things you discovered and maybe some of the surprises or some of the highlights of what you saw across the board there with differences due to playing the pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the biggest factor for me was the absence of the crowd. I mean, that was very, very clear that had huge impact on the game and the decisions that players were making. And the fact that, so that Manchester United went unbeaten away from home in every single game. And it was the first ever Premier League season. And I've not done the research kind of ever, but I'd imagine possibly, certainly the Premier League era and then potentially going back to 80s, 70s maybe, it was the first season ever in the Premier League that there was more away wins than home wins.
Yeah.
So that
that's
is
the, that's the one thing I remember noticing or hearing spoken about quite a lot, and you could see it, couldn't you? And I mean, I guess you linked that with the fact there's the supporters there, or but there could also be, I guess, referee influence. There's lots of things going on with that, right? So just to drive that outcome.
The refereeing, kind of on average, they did less bookings for the away team, less sending offs. The thing about the subs, the increase that you could make 5 subs, that was interesting to see which teams did that. And I know even now, currently now in 2022, some of the lower teams in leagues are potentially complaining about the reintroduction of more subs because they think it benefits the bigger teams.
With bigger squads.
But actually, if you looked at the data, that there was a lot of teams lower that used the maximum 5 more than the top teams did, which was quite interesting, quite a surprise. And then that's the whole scheduling argument of, I think it was Man United who played 3 games in 6 days in one spell. So from a physiological perspective, it's physically impossible to recover from a Premier League game within 2 or 3 days. It's like biology, where the classic argument are they're on 200 grand a week, they should be able to play. Yeah, it's great that they're on 200 grand a week, probably too much, but that doesn't make the cells recover quicker. That's irrelevant. So that element and how managers use the squad and how players, you got to see how robust some players or how not robust some players were, and dealing with those elements of playing more and more. And something which, as I say, on hindsight with time, and I'm not really sure how I would have kind of quantified this unless I could have literally interviewed players, but I always felt something that I would love to know a bit more, and I don't think the media have kind of gone into it in enough detail, is how comfortable were the players or staff themselves actually being out of the house, being out of the training ground, travelling around the country in the middle of a pandemic when the government are telling everyone to stay at home, don't go out to work if you can help it. From a, I don't know, like a moral perspective, how do you feel knowing like the NHS are getting battered every day and you're going to, say if you're a football player in London and you're playing Newcastle, you're travelling the length and breadth of the country for a game of football that in reality it's a great release for a lot of people, and myself included. When I remember when Germany were the first big league to come back in, and I was all over German football like I'd never been before, just to watch some stuff. But from a moral perspective and the amount of backlash that if it was a big name player from a big club saying, no, I'm literally not playing, it would have been really interesting to see how that would have gone. And again, I'm not really sure, even in hindsight, I'm not really sure how I would have operated with that within the book without literally speaking directly to pro players. But that kind of social element of, were they actually comfortable, not just playing every 2 or 3 days and getting injured and wrecking the bodies, but that moral element, should we really be doing this? And there was a lot obviously made around the money of the Premier League and the smaller clubs struggling and that side of things.
And I guess, yeah, Sam, for some of those players and managers and the coaching teams involved in that, it may not even be a conscious bias, mightn't it? It may be something you don't think's bothering you, but it could be without you even knowing it, right? Because, you're right. I mean, the players you see on the pitch, the managers you often see, but the whole team, the coaching staff around them as well, you know, there's going to be some moral dilemmas there that can have maybe... It can come from a subconsciously, can't it? You know, in a approach to match day or training sessions and stuff, and a little bit like, should we be doing this? You know, you might not say those words, but it can be sensed, right? And that can impact on the players, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I guess it's some of the ways where, can you measure it? Can you not? If it's subconscious, then yeah, there's probably ways they're not. And I guess it would probably only come through reflection of the players and the staff where now they can look back and say, because I read an interview this morning with Paul Pogba saying he's been suffering from that bouts of depression whilst he's been at Man United. And it's some of that could be partly because obviously the pandemic that, you know, with playing obviously for Premier League first teams, normally from the big crowds around the world, although they're all unbelievably talented and really mentally strong, they are still people and they will still feel pressure in games and matches. It's only human. Although they can handle it better than probably you and me could handle it, but they're still human and there will be an element of they will get some nerves. So when Man City play Liverpool in a few weeks, that's probably looking likely to decide the league, players will have some nerves because it's a huge occasion.
Of course.
And then without players, I guess, having the release of, I guess in normal times where they can go and see friends, go and see family, particularly there's a lot of foreign players in England in the Premier League where if the player's from Africa, for example, and all their family still live in Africa and they don't see family much at home anyway, but then they can have that release going out with teammates or socialising. You take that away as well as, then you're almost always on alert from a job and performance perspective and you're never getting that easing, that like, it's like a balloon that you never get the reduction to reset and go again. It's almost like you're staying pumped and then eventually you're gonna burst. So that element was really fascinating. And again, it would be a great kind of insight, I guess, if you could get a load of players in a room one day and those that played every minute or most minutes, for example, see what they actually really felt.
Did your analysis highlight anything significant with regards to tactics? Did people play the same way despite what was going on, or did you see people making some changes to how they approached games or how they played in games, I should say?
Yeah, there was a lot of kind of different ideas in terms of, I mean, every season there's new ideas that come up anyway, but there was kind of some ones where I think you could kind of guess again with no fans and the lack of the presence of fans that I think some teams were a little bit more focused on playing out from the goalkeeper a little bit shorter. And don't forget as well, it was the first season where the goal kick rule changed to you can receive in the penalty area. So teams were experimenting with that. And if you're away from home, one of the big clubs, for example, with a big crowd, you're probably less inclined to do that. Whereas with no fans, and if you make a mistake, then... you know, that element of it is probably taken away a little bit. So a lot more teams were trying differently in terms of how they built. You've got like loads of different ways of attacking. So a lot of kind of new rotations where players were ending up in new positions that they might not have if the presence of the home crowd. Say if it was 0-0 and there was a couple of rotations, for instance, Brighton and Sheffield United were great at this, where they play with three centre-backs and one of them pushes forward and overlaps or underlaps and gets ahead of the wing back or even ahead of the in line with the striker sometimes. If you're kind of 0-0 at home and you're expecting to win the game and the fans are getting on you because we've not scored yet, whether he makes that run or not is very different to there's no fans here, it's 0-0, but let's stay calm. No one's booing us. You know, there's no internal pressure on us from a fan and crowd and atmosphere perspective. Let's try that. And I think there was a bit of an element more of trying new ideas in different phases of the game. And it was interesting to see that there was teams like Leeds, for example, last year compared to this year, I know they've had a lot of injuries and stuff and bits of changes that way, but they seem to play with a lot more, I don't want to say freedom, but kind of less fear because, again, there are no fans that... Because Bielsa's style was extremely expansive and there's going to be a lot of positive play, but there's also going to be a few mistakes and errors, and his games were often very high scoring in both ways. But as soon as you put the home crowd in, And if you're conceding 3, 4, 5 like they have done at home, that is a very different atmosphere from, right, we're conceding 2s and 3s, but, you know, we believe we can get back into this. So that was quite interesting. And again, as I said, the book tries to highlight different ways of playing and then the positives of different ways of playing, because it seems like Man City and Liverpool, although they attack the most and they create and they score the most, they will also defend in a low block and really deep for a little bit of it, nearly every game, because that's the way football is. You when you're defending, there will be moments where they defend their own penalty area.
Yeah.
But there will be some teams that defend the penalty area more than others through choice, and some that do it through the way the opposition is playing. So I wanted to kind of, as I said, cover the teams that did it by choice and did it really well, and then the teams that did something else differently by choice and then did it really well. And most of it is all kind of the positive of different styles, and hopefully kind of coaches or analysts or even, you know, general football fans can read it and say, oh, the team's sitting off, for example, but they're doing it with a purpose and they're doing it through control of the game. They're not doing it because, oh, the other team's got the ball, we must be getting hammered. No, they're actually in quite control of the game, and it's their preferred way of playing and they're very good at it. So there's loads of stuff. As I say, every season brings something new, but yeah, with that COVID thrown in as well, it's
Even more so. Well, there's two things that I want to ask you about. It might be in the book or they might be touched on, it might be your opinions. The first one then will be about, you mentioned about Pogba. Like, I read the same thing too with him. It struck me slightly watching football during the pandemic, because some of the superstars didn't really shine as much. It was just the fact that they're used to playing in front of, you know, 50,000 fans and have their name chanted. They didn't seem to shine as much. And also what it struck me as, and now I'm an Arsenal fan here, so maybe it was just a bit of time with who we had coming through the system at the time. But the youth did shine a bit more. The younger players. Now, I'm trying to look for positives here in the sense of, you know, what happened over that year or so. But is that something you saw, or is it a feeling you had as well? If I got that wrong, maybe I've just kind of just seen what I wanted to see and that wasn't the case. But I felt like youth came through, a lot of young players shone and come up, and some of the superstars, not they were bad by any stretch, but they were maybe quite as dominant as they might have been previously.
Yeah, I think there's an element to that. There was some stuff that I think about putting in terms of, so like the use of subs will have helped, that you can now put two more players on. So that young player on the bench has now got two more chances to go on.
Good point, yeah.
As opposed to just the normal three. With, again, games being played in such a condensed period, and obviously that the Euros was then in the back of clearly the Premier League's mind, that not only have we got to kind of wrap up the season quite quickly, but we have to finish it earlier than we normally would do, like we do any pre-World Cup or Euros tournament, because we've got that. And then I think as well, I hope they had it in mind, but with the World Cup this year being mid-season for the first time ever, that's thrown even more kind of scheduling issues into an already messed up situation. So from a recovery perspective, again, stereotyping, there's obviously always exceptions to the norm, but a 22, 23-year-old is going to recover quicker and better than a 32-year-old or a 30-year-old. Obviously, like I say, like Ronaldo, who's an absolute specimen at 35, 36, there's some players that are just against the norm, obviously, but stereotypically, they'll get less injuries and they'll recover quicker from any injuries, because it's biology. It's you're better and you're better, certainly in an athletic perspective, you're going to be better in that youth from a physical perspective in terms of recovery. So there might have been an element there of, because I mentioned that recovery element, but I didn't kind of go into what you just said about the youth. That's an interesting point. So that could have been a part where they look fresher in training, because physically they can be. So then they might, again, consciously, subconsciously, the managers might pick them a bit more. And then, again, going back to the home crowd, that will have definitely eased them into Premier League football with going to Old Trafford and there's nobody there. Although every player would tell you, yeah, we'd like it to be full because it's the occasion. But there will be elements of going, you know what? It's quite nice to settle into a first environment where I don't have to focus on anything external. It is all internal between the white lines.
So that's how I took it, Sam. I kind of felt like some young players were less inhibited, maybe because of the lack of the home and away support, right? It wasn't quite the same pressure. I imagine they play a lot of tough games, you know, anyway, but the crowds aren't always there like that. And then you think, well, actually, if I'm a young player and even I'm not getting selected just yet, but I'm close and I see the next one above me getting game time, now I'm going to kick on a little bit. And I could be completely wrong, but I kind of get a sense, you know, especially in the Premier League teams, that there's a lot of good young players coming through. And it can't just be a coincidence. And maybe it's just the fact that the academy system's got better than everything else. But I kind of felt like if there was a silver lining in some of this, you know, the COVID situation over the last couple of years, then maybe that's one of them where youth's got a bit more opportunity because, like you said, game time and subs and things. But also the fact they've been able to shine a bit more because they haven't felt so inhibited and been able to express themselves. And then the players next layer down also, well, I can get there now as well. And we're seeing that growth. So I'm sure it's not just, you know, England. I'm sure that's probably something that all the countries have, or hopefully they've seen, but I could be clutching at straws there, kind of thing. But it feels like that could be something that's a positive.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's part of the reason I'm saying that the England national team now is doing better is, like, for me, one, the academy system has got better in the last kind of 10 years anyway, and it is very, there's flaws with it, definitely. There's issues with it, certainly on kind of some of the money side, or in particular on the amount of players that try and play and then get released and then kind of fall by the wayside a little bit. That's a big issue that we need to kind of not solve, because you'll never solve that, because ultimately being a footballer is, you've got like a 0.01% chance of making it anyway. And there's only 11 shirts available on a Saturday lunchtime. So you've got to be within that 1 in 11 out of every young lad in the world that wants to make it. So the chances are slim anyway, but that's probably a bit of a drawback to the academy system, which, again, going off on a tangent, but I think like you just said there, the seeing other players taking that chance or being afforded that chance is certainly better. And the element of the big players potentially not performing as they could be doing, and it's quite interesting, something I've noticed this year is if you look at the players that certainly started or had a big involvement for England at the Euros last year and then obviously lost in the final, that's probably one of the most traumatic experience any English footballer will ever go through, is to lose a final on penalties in a national final at Wembley. You can't get a more traumatic experience than that. The majority, if not all of those players that say were in that 11 or in that squad, started this season quite poorly. So if you look at people like Kane, Mount, Saka, all those players, Sancho, their best form is just right now, kind of post-Christmas. A lot of those players, Maguire, a lot of those players, Pickford, most of those have had quite a poor start to the season and then found their feet as the season's gone on. So I feel that psychological element of, potentially other players not performing during the pandemic and some players, younger players, performing very well, will have that other flip side effect that the other young players will see that and go, well, yeah, it's like anything. You see your mate do it, first thing you think of is, why can't I do that? Well, actually, I probably can. Yeah. It's kind of like basic human psychology, isn't it? Without kind of going off into too many theories, and that, I'm sure that will have it's trying to measure the unmeasurable. If it's happening, then there must be a way to measure it somehow. But there definitely was that element of that, and that again, one positive that I still certainly feel that there should be kind of at least four subs in the way the game is now, and the amount of distance they run and the amount of games players are expected to play, irrelevant of how much they're paid. I have no problem with them playing two or three times a week, because that's more games, more exposure for different clubs and teams, and ultimately another position for one of the young lads in the academy to potentially make it as a career. So I think that could be a positive that again comes back, because I think they are still trying to review that subs rule, aren't they, currently again. That probably was one of the few positives that came from that period.
And Sam, what about possession? Looking at the stats at the end of games now, I'm seeing more and more teams with lower percentages but getting results still, you know. But that was that a trend pre-pandemic, or is that something that's just increased because of the pandemic, or just that's the way football's evolved? You see more teams getting 1-1s, 2-1 wins with 30% possession than ever before. It's probably the most misleading indicator of success is your possession stat. But is that something that's just football evolving, or is that anything to do with the pandemic, in your opinion?
No, I don't think that's a pandemic thing. I think the way that the pandemic will affect the game is teams will have been probably more inclined to have less of the ball when they're at home without the crowd than if they were at home. I think they would have taken the foot off the gas a bit earlier and absorbed pressure for longer compared to if the fans were there. Because like you say, then if a lot of kind of fans and pundits and just as a general thought feel that if the team hasn't got the ball, then they're not doing well. One of my favourite coaches and teams to watch is Atletico Madrid, because I've not seen many teams like Simeone that control a game without having the ball. So I think that's true for the pandemic. But I did a presentation recently for the Premier League, and the out of possession section of it focused on the so-called Big Six. And the first thing I did was looked at the data from around 5 to 6 years ago to then the season we're in now, 21-22. And the like possession swing, I call it, between when those Big Six play each other. And this season, in 21-22, I think it was off the top of my head, if I can remember the numbers, it was 23 or 24% swing of possession kind of between the two as an average. So it would be kind of like you 65 to 35, that kind of, well, a 23 gap. Yep. Whereas 5 or 6 years ago, it was an average of between, I think it was about 10 to 14, I think just say 14. So there's been a bigger swing between kind of less of the 50-50, 55-45 in the Big Six to a 60-35, even 70-30 sometimes between the Big Six. So now you're getting teams that are obviously the so-called top-end teams sitting back a lot more, a lot longer, and allowing the other team to have the ball. And a few years ago, it would have been a lot more even between first and second, first and fourth in terms of possession. That might have an influence due to the coaches we've got now. So obviously Guardiola is going to look to dominate the ball all the time. But it's some of the data came from games where it was a Chelsea v Spurs or the other one, Liverpool v Chelsea, for example, where Thomas Tuchel, one game tried to dominate the ball and then the other one, they totally sat off. So that flexibility, I think it has been really insightful, that I think it's a bit naive now to say teams play really one defined way. You have to have a lot of tools in your locker to be able to adapt. And the game probably a couple of months ago now, where Tottenham beat Man City at Manchester City, I think it was like a Saturday evening game, where again, Tottenham were really deep, really compact. And it was one of the first games where I saw Man City at home couldn't really find a way to break that kind of block, because 90% of teams go to Manchester City and set up quite deep, because not only do they have to, but it's probably one of the best ways to get something against City.
Yeah.
Because it would be very brave to go hell for leather and go at them. So the majority of teams do that anyway, by hook or by crook, but that was one of the first games where I felt, certainly in the first kind of first half, first hour, where I really felt, you know what, Tottenham look totally in control here. They've not had the ball. They've taken the chances that they get the goal that you'll need to defend. You need a lead to defend, obviously. But it really felt that they were in control of the game despite not having the ball. And I think that is, again, one of the evolutions of the way the game's going, is I think people are realising that, yeah, we can control the game with the ball. Like me, myself, personally, I would always feel a lot more comfortable controlling games with the ball than without it. But there is that element of, and again, the book touches on this, that you can have success in different ways. And success to one team might be, you know what, we have 30% possession, but when we do have that 30, we know what we're doing with it. And then when we have that 70 without it, we're outstanding at what we do. And that's all you can ever be, is outstanding at what you do.
And I recognise this wasn't the purpose of the book. The book is fascinating and covers some really interesting topics. And I love what you spoke about so far. But is there anything that coaches can take out of it? I mean, if I'm working with young players in the, you know, foundation or youth development phase, I mean, is there anything in this book that I can say, actually, do you know what, I can look at that and that could help me maybe think about the sessions that I run or the way in which I approach my coaching?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, predominantly, it's lots of tactical information. So for kind of older players, that would go quite hand in hand. But as we've discussed a few times now, that flexibility is key to be able to defend and attack in different ways. So hopefully the book can kind of cover, even if you do want to dominate the ball and be an attacking kind of team and have lots of passes, there's elements of, well, you need to press specific ways and then you need to defend specific ways as well. So then you can take that out and tie that in. There's lots of technical detail in the book as well, which I feel is important for any player in any age group. There's a bit of a section when Brighton were particularly good at, when they were playing forwards, they were disguising the passes quite well, and kind of the body shape would bring a defender or multiple defenders one way, and then they just reverse the pass kind of across the other way, and that the timing of that. And I went into a bit of the detail on that in terms of just the timing of techniques and steps and movements, and that can be applied to any player. So there's lots of technical detail in there. Ultimately, as I say, I've worked with almost all age groups now below kind of 20. There's still elements and tactical concepts that I would work with 9, 10-year-olds at 77 that you would do with first team, because the principles of play are similar. And you might work with, say, in a 7v7 format or environment, you might work with your striker and saying, well, when is it good to run towards the ball and run towards back towards our own goal? Or when is it good not to? And that space, what's affected that? So although you're not using the terminology of a false nine, you're not using the terminology of kind of different movements and patterns, and it's not all stop, stand stills and move here, move there. You work with an individual player and say, well, if the space is there and you can receive the ball by running to it and someone's ahead of you, you go and do that. So then straight away, it's the same tactical concept. You're just not using all the terminology that you would use with the older players. So there are tactical elements that you can work with any player, and certainly trying to tie in the principles of play. So something that would be, we were talking about earlier about your perfect session. Kind of one of the, like, the non-negotiables for me from a tactical element is width ripped from the wingers for me. So I want my widest players to be wingers almost all the time. I wouldn't want going kind of against what the Premier League's been a lot of in recent years. I'm not saying I don't like, but I'm not a massive fan of the winger coming in on the stronger foot. So that left footer on the right. I much prefer a right footer on the right, a left footer on the left, to give more space in the middle for other players and different rotations for me that I feel can progress and pin the opposition back better anyway. But you can do that with the under nines, under tens, and working with your wing, you say, oh, can you come as wide as you can? And if you get the ball, go 1v1 and you might lose it. Try your best to win it back and then come out again, go 1v1 again. Or it might be to the centre mid, it might be, well, if our winger's over there, where's the space that you can get on it? And you can probe and ask loads of questions and just highlight different pockets of space. But it's still tactical. It's not technical information. The winger hugging the touchline and the nine dropping short or centre mid running forward is tactical points. But it's just how you speak to a nine-year-old about it. It's the art of the delivery and knowing the terminology, knowing to the best of your ability how a 9 and 10-year-old brain works. And then ultimately, the age and stage. So something I discuss a lot with coaches that I certainly didn't do myself enough when I worked with the younger players, and is always not necessarily regret, but always something that I wish I did more, was link the tactical elements of the game to an individual player's kind of strengths and weaknesses in terms of, so in the academy system, what we've highlighted are their strengths and what we're trying to work on with them individually to make them better, or that one thing that might stop them progressing through the age groups. So if we've said with a player, for example, that his 1v1 defending isn't particularly the best, well then, on the game day, I should be setting up that defender to defend on his own as much as I can. Yeah. Because if I don't do that, I'm not doing my job. So from a tactical perspective, I might tell my winger ahead of him, if he's a fullback, for the first 20 minutes, I don't want you tracking back. I want you to stay out high and wide, let little Johnny defend one versus one. He might get absolutely battered for 20 minutes, then we go, right, now come back in and let's get your shape and we'll defend, not properly, but more like we would do. So then the tactical element there, you are then probably creating different counter-attacks for your winger. The roles of the nine and the centre-mids are then different, because when you press the ball, if they've got a 2v1 overload on that side, they're going to press the ball the other way. So there will be some moments where he doesn't defend 1v1. But hopefully the opposition can recognise and see, well, he's got a 1v1 or a 2v1 against in huge spaces. So that little defender then gets loads of repetition at the stuff that he's not great at yet. And if he's still not great at it, we can highlight why and try and help him. Or I often find this is quite a brave thing to do as a coach, where the first few times they get absolutely rinsed and you might be 2-0 down, you can't start conceding. But then all it takes is that third or fourth time for him to win his 1v1 and set up the counter-attack. And then linking it to some of the stuff we were saying earlier about the young players breaking into the first team. Once they feel like they've done it once, a lot of players are a lot smarter than we give them credit for, where they tend to pick up quite quickly. Well, I did that last time. I pressed him this way, or I put one foot in front of the other quicker, or whatever I did, I'm going to try that again. And that might help the learning. So with the younger players, I would always say try and link the tactics to their individual traits as a player, both positive and negative. And then it comes back to the very first question about what is your kind of coaching idea. There's your personalised approach with it. There's your detail and your tactics. And then there's your honesty, I guess, as well, because you're highlighting what they're doing well, because that's really important. If a fullback is great 1v1 defending, in my head, certainly in the academy system, I want to go, right, I want to make him outstanding. I want to make him the best in the club or the best in the region, the best in the country. So let's isolate him 1v1 even more, tell the winger not to track back. But there he might win 6 out of 8 1v1s. So there you're making him really, really get the consistency element of if he's good at that. So you can get that tactical kind of points with the younger players for development as much as the kind of result.
I mean, Sam, that wasn't part of the podcast, but you touched on some great stuff there because it is about being brave, right? And I wonder, like in the academy system, I think there's license to do that. And obviously I think the system allows coaches to be brave as well as players, obviously encourage that because results aren't maybe as important. The challenge you've got, I think, in grassroots, especially the weekends and the Sunday games is, you know, coaches don't want to lose their games. So I guess one possible way around this is to try and encourage grassroots teams to have friendly matches that aren't maybe your Sunday league games. Play on a Saturday, maybe skip every 3 weeks training and play a match in which you'll be brave there and do, you know, let the players, you know, be overly tested and test their super strengths out, recognizing they're going to get challenged more and it builds resilience and everything like that. Because I think that's a challenge you get now with the academy players kicking on and doing really well when they kind of get signed at maybe under nines and go on at under 11s and 12s, and the other boys that were maybe or girls were potentially close, or that gap gets a bit wider because they're not getting exposed to some of these stuff that you get in the academy system. Great quote coaching, obviously, and maybe more hours, but actually it's the opportunity to be brave and be tested. I think that's the biggest difference between maybe the grassroots space and the academy space. And yeah, I mean, you said it there brilliantly, and I guess it's just up to coaches now to find ways in which they can try and replicate that in a way that they're comfortable doing and can support the players, right? Would you recommend that? Am I talking nonsense, or is that fair to say? You can tell me the honest answer, Sam. I'm talking rubbish. Just tell me.
Yeah, you've got to be so brave to do that as a coach, because I mean, I've got a younger brother who's kind of at the end of his kind of school life now. So I've watched him play grassroots a lot. Well, not a lot because of work, but as much as I can at different ages and stages. And sometimes, well, nearly every time I go, I won't say anything to anybody because I don't want to kind of get involved. I just want him to be there and enjoy playing. But I'll see things and I'm thinking, like, no, this is not quite right. And I do feel for the coach more often than not, because that it's funny. We're talking about the absence of a crowd at the top level. The amount of events that I've been to as an academy coach that are parent free, and the difference in the players is frightening.
That's amazing. And
you've got to have that balance at grassroots. It's very difficult to say you're not coming to watch your child, because A, you're paying money, and B, it's their child. So you don't kind of have the right really to do that. But there is also kind of that borderline approach that, you know, ultimately in kind of 5, 10, 15, however many years time, players won't remember the score of grassroots games. Players don't remember the score in academy games, because I don't remember the score from 3 weeks ago because A, my memory is rubbish, and B, it's not as important as some of the other stuff. There's that balance to strike of, well, maybe sometimes it could be, why don't we have a parent-free morning? And then from a coaching perspective, we could do, you know, a little bit more of that side of development things. I think making it as two-way as you can in terms of, I guess it depends what the aims of kind of the club and the environment is. If there's an element of, we're here to enjoy a play and we literally just want players to turn up and really enjoy themselves, we're not going to give them things to work on. They just want to play football, play, get minutes, everyone gets the same. That's your club objective. Everyone knows where they're at. If it, again, still in grassroots, you say, oh, actually, we want a bit of development here and there. We want them to improve as well as enjoying it. Okay, well, let's come up with some kind of system and structure that's a bit more formalised, where the parents are very black and white in terms of their understanding of, they might get one point that they're really good at and one point that they're not so good at. And in games, there will be moments where that one point that they're not good at is going to get stretched. And then just constantly reaffirming and raising with parents that, ultimately, if this is the environment that we're kind of creating, and you've agreed that your, you know, your son or daughter wants to play for this team and are happy for us as coaches to potentially expose them to a weakness or also expose them to their strength, this is what our environment's going to look like.
Yeah.
And I've had so many conversations with parents at various levels that they either just don't get it or they don't want to get it. And then you do everything you can, but ultimately it comes back to that being really brave as a coach and sometimes being willing to take the flak and going, you know what? I know full well that I'm doing the best for your child in terms of what we've agreed as aims. If the parent wants to give you stick, it says a lot more about them than you or the child, bless them. So, it takes a very brave coach to do that. And I guess it depends on, how kind of structured your environment is in terms of an agreement to what that environment is. So it doesn't have to be structured in terms of like your training and what we're doing. Like I say, it could be just a group of players that turn up once a week and just play because they love kicking a ball around. That is your environment. Great. But you can still structure it kind of externally and in terms of your organization as that's the environment and making everybody clear that, that's what that is. So I guess that's the main focus around that. But I totally appreciate that it's very difficult at any level to, automatically, if players aren't doing well in the game, a lot of people straight away think that's bad. But as we say, take the positives out of it and ultimately you stretch your weaknesses, but also build on your strengths.
And I guess that's the point, isn't it, Sam? Be clear about what your philosophy is, what you're trying to achieve, and try and take the parents and everyone with you on that journey. What, you know, whatever is probably is okay as long as you're clear about it and you're consistent with it. I guess that's the trick. It's just, you know, sometimes that development over results, you know, that's that clash, isn't it? And just finding a happy medium between that is always the challenge, I guess, for all of us. Sam, that's been brilliant, mate. Honestly, I'm so grateful for your time. You've done a great job of going through the book. The book sounds fascinating. I'm sure it was interesting to do the analysis. With all the greatest respect in the world, I hope there's not a version two. another pandemic. But you could always do one on what it's like to play a World Cup mid-season. Maybe there's some analysis in that one, maybe.
Yeah.
But Sam, before we let you go, we ask all our guests this one question. You may have touched on it already, I don't know, but if you don't mind elaborating, if you have, or something different. If there was one thing you could change about the world of coaching, what might that be?
Well, certainly in England specifically would be the money. And what I mean by that is the amount of money that is in the game, there's got to be ways that the whole game is proportionate better and spread out better than it has been and currently is. Because don't get me wrong, the first team players at every level are the best of the best. They are the absolute pinnacle, elite of athletic performance and technical and tactical quality. They deserve to be paid quite handsomely because they are, again, there's 25 players in every squad times 20 is what, 500 players. So they're 500 of the best couple of thousand players in the world. They should be paid handsomely. But when as soon as you hear kind of 70, 100, 150, 200, 300 grand a week, straight away, it's always been a problem for me that I don't blame them for accepting it, because if somebody rang me up tomorrow and said, do you want 100 grand a week? There's no way I'm saying no.
Yeah.
No matter what job it is, I'd coach for free then on the evenings and I'd do this 100 grand a week job. There's no doubt about it. But there has to be some kind of way, and obviously it's difficult for, say, England just to do it and then not Spain, France, Germany, because all the players will just go. So for me, there has to be a collective effort for kind of FIFA, UEFA, for all the big governing bodies that they say they care about the game, they say about making it a global game and all this. But I never understood why quite a basic salary cap, 50 grand a week, 75 grand a week, is still an absolutely extortionate amount of money over a year, ultimately for playing football, which, again, they're the best of the best, so they should be paid well. But as soon as you go from 50 grand a week to 100 grand a week to 200 grand a week, for me, we're losing the point of everything. And you think about that money then that you then save, that can go into staff wages in terms of coaches, analysts, strength and conditioning, medical, physios, recruitment, all staff at a club, groundsmen, media, receptionists, cleaners, everyone straight away, they can get a bump. The amount of money that can then be pumped into facilities, the amount of money that can get pumped into transport, so players that can't get access to pitches can now get access to pitches, the amount of money that could go into grassroots, so not one team in the country turns up and there's a hole in the net. Imagine something as simple as that, where every single grassroots game has a perfect net on it. Something as very basic and simple as that. Every grassroots game has four corner flags.
And some white lines and, and the grass cut, yeah.
So the proportion and the balance of money in the game for me has been wrong for ages, and it will be fantastic if, I mean, it's wishful thinking and kind of utopia, perfect world, but it will be fantastic for the game at all levels if they did reorganise the way the finances are spread. And as I say, not forgetting about the first team because they're the best of the best and they deserve it. But you're not telling me that that kind of 50 grand a week, say, is just a ballpark figure, that it is not more than enough to not just live off, but kind of build the rest of your life from. And because, you know, the first team players, they do make sacrifices. Of course, they have. I listened to, I can't remember who said it, Gerard, wasn't it? Yeah. Saying about how he's got like loads of screws in his hips and stuff. And people forget about that side of things, that they struggle physically, like mobility after their back goes, ankles. Loads of surgeries, like 20 surgeries in 5 years. They push their body to the limit, so there should be some element of compensation after that as well. But, yeah, it is very frustrating that we're very lucky in football as a sport that the amount of money that's involved, because you look at tennis, cricket, I don't know, name any other sports, yeah. They would absolutely kill to have the funding, the finances that football gets. They would absolutely kill for that, wouldn't they? So, I think as a collective, I think football could be a lot smarter in how they do that. And I would love for that to be in England, because I think not only would you get a better England national team, not only would you get better coaches and better staff in every kind of every environment, from the kitchen staff to the first team manager in every club, which then makes better players anyway. You would also get a better pyramid as a whole from top to bottom. And every single person that's involved in that, whether you're a player, parent, staff, volunteer, whatever you are, everybody's life will be made better. There's no downside to... The only downside would be the player on 300 grand a week goes to 50. That's the only downside from it. And I'm sure if it was made a blanket thing, I don't think one player would really complain at that.
Can be quite scary, Sam, seeing some of these jobs that get advertised around coaching. I mean, it's not just coaching, but around coaching, where, you know, what you need and what you need to have put yourself through to kind of get the qualifications and position that they're looking for. And then when you look to what the salary is paying, you compare it to most other industries, in which if you'd put that many hours into your CPD and personal development, if you do that in accountancy or finance or something else, you're probably giving quite a handsome wage. But in coaching, it just doesn't seem to reflect. And maybe I'm biased because I like the world of coaching and, you know, it's not my career, that's for sure. But I couldn't afford it to be my career, to be honest with you, Sam. Even if I was good enough to be able to get to that level, I would struggle to do that on the finances that it offers. And it doesn't seem quite right. And that's not a dig at the top paid players. It's just the whole system seems a little bit out of sync, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to make coaching a career, I've always said this, and it still rings true to this day now for this podcast, that I've had to make certain choices and lifestyle choices to have the career that I've got. And there is definitely a decision to be made that, you know, some people might think about it daily. So I certainly think about it kind of once every year. I'll try and plan bits of your life out. And you do think what's important to you in this moment in time. And don't get me wrong, for me, it's the best job in the world to work in football and coach and analyse and stuff. But the reality of the world is everyone has bills to pay.
Yeah.
Everyone has things to, particularly with the cost of living going up. And my biggest bugbear with that is, I think part of the reason why some of the jobs advertised in, it might be a coaching job, or it might be a strength and conditioning analyst, whatever it is, part of the reason why the jobs are paid for so low is kind of one, the first team budget is so high that they have to literally save every penny and scrape every budget you can that's not first team. But two, there is always somebody willing to work for next to nothing or nothing that then not ruins it for everyone else, but then makes it very
difficult. Yeah, they'll fill the position, right? That's the problem. They'll get the place. But then it's quality, Sam, right? It's the quality of applicant. And I'm not looking at that, because there's some great people out there, but it makes you wonder, if you paid a bit more, imagine the pool of players you could have, the pool of coaches or applicants you could have. And then sure, that's going to then hopefully create even more top flight players. So therefore that increases. I know it's only a bit numbers still, but actually the inequality is getting better. So it seems to me like we just need to kind of flip a little bit on its head and turn it around a little bit, not a massive change, but just a bit of a tweak. And then suddenly, you know, it becomes more positive the right way around than the negative.
Absolutely. I mean, honestly, I'm so passionate about this that like the bigger salary is obviously better for everybody. Nobody would turn down a raise or a bigger salary, but there's got to be, as I said, there's got to be smarter ways that whilst, because we don't know that football will have the money that it does now forever. You don't know this.
Things do change, don't they?
You can take it for granted. You know, with this potential Super League coming in and what that does to the game, that matter. I still think it's coming in. I really do. I don't think it's dead in the water. I think the Premier League teams are okay because they've got the Premier League brand behind them. But I think the other countries are certainly not going behind their back. But I think have made it quite clear that we're going to do this with or without you. Yeah, the kind of finances and ultimately, if you can get more people working in the game and better people working in the game that might not have had a chance before, like you say, the players benefit, but the whole pyramid as a whole benefits. And as I said, there is no real downside to it, that you get more people in the game, you can get hopefully people from a more diverse background or a less fortunate background that can then get involved in the game. Doesn't even have to be first team or in academies, just get them involved in the game more, because the opportunity is there, because there's more bursaries, because there's more courses paid. I mean, I'm a professional coach. I've worked at 3 or 4 clubs. And even I had to pay for my A licence myself at the time. I had to pay $3,500 to go on my A licence because at the point in time, that was the way my career, my job role, my titles and everything was set for me. So I picked basically not taking that out of a potential house deposit, taking that out of not going on holiday for 2 years and saving quite aggressively, quite quickly, to because I got a place on the A licence and I didn't want to, because I know so how hard it is to get on it. And again, talking about the luck element, it was the first time I applied for it. So the first time I applied, I got on it. So I obviously did something right in the application stage.
But in most careers, Sam, right? If you know your employer pays for your CPD and development, then that's kind of how it's in most careers, you know, because you're a value team and it kind of gets, you know, they get the return on that investment by backing you, you know, and even if you move around, you know, someone else will come in and do the thing. So it does seem strange, and you are right. I'm sure it's part of that is because they know they're going to fill the positions, right? There's demand out there still, and fair play. But your point there about how many people can't take those positions, they literally can't afford to do it. And the quality of people that we're missing out on because they literally had economic, they can't do it. You've made sacrifices that you've just been able to do and make it work for you. But some people can't make the sacrifices at all. And it just feels a bit of a shame, especially when there is money in football. It's just the way it's allocated is a bit disproportionate to where it needs to be. Don't want to finish on negative, but it's always good to hear people's thoughts. And I'm sure that we won't change anything overnight. But who knows? It's the more we talk about it, the more we shine a light on it, you never know what might happen. Sam, what's your plans moving forward? Are you happy where you are and what you're going to be doing? Or is there, I'm not essentially going to leave what you're doing, but what's your hope, aspirations for the next maybe 5 years or so?
Yeah, as I say, I'm always, kind of every environment I've been in, I've always been happy and settled. I've never not really enjoyed an environment. And you just kind of, as I say, stay adaptable and offers might come in when you least expect them. And you, like everything you assess, you see, is it time to leave and stay? This is my first season at Villa. So I'm still very much in the element of adapting to the way the club works compared to other clubs I've worked at. And I'm enjoying that process. I'm still enjoying the analysis process. I've been doing work for the Coach's Voice for about 4 years now. And then the Premier League, this is my kind of first season doing content for them. The book is obviously quite new. I've also had quite a few people kind of approaches to start some kind of YouTube social media tactical stuff. I don't really know what or how yet. That is looking like it could begin in the next few months, certainly towards the end of this season, potentially as a little side project as well as. So I think in the short term, it's going to be a lot more of, I'm quite conscious that I want to give more kind of tactical stuff and certainly content out to as many different people as I can without, you know, I don't want to say I know everything on the know it of all truths and it's the be all and end all, but I've taken so much from so many people, as we just discussed earlier, that I think it's only right that I make more of a conscious effort to give stuff back and try and tie it in with my strengths that I'm good at. So that'll be a huge part, but certainly, yeah, just keep plugging away as a career in the UK and I'd imagine, you know, still in the academy systems and working forward. And I've always kind of had the end goal from a coaching perspective is kind of the under-18s side. That's my end goal. I'm not too interested in the first team as such. I mean, if I got offered it tomorrow, I definitely wouldn't say no, but it's never been a make or break. That 18s is still kind of a career goal, and the stuff that I've done at clubs and your individualised coaching programme that players get,
Yeah.
You know, my kind of program is geared around to all the CPD, all the interviews, meetings, and all the stuff that I do, the extra bits alongside my roles, is geared around preparing me for that job role, if you like. So I would like to say, yeah, in the next kind of 4 to 5 years, hopefully, kind of knocking on the door in and around that phase. But for the time being, yeah, keep learning, keep enjoying the game, and keep surviving the crazy world that is football.
Brilliant, Sam. Well, if you start putting content out, I'll be all over that. So yeah, I'll be one of those thieves nicking all your ideas and trying to make it work in my little spaces. So thanks so much, Sam. Look, I said it'd be about an hour or so, and it's been about an hour and a half, but that's just because it's been fascinating talking to you. The book's a fascinating insight into how external influences can impact on the choices you make and how they play out in practice, which is brilliant. Thank you for sharing that. And just your coaching journey more broadly and what it is you do. It's been fascinating to speak about some of your philosophy and your ideas. So thanks so much. If people want to find out more about you and what you're up to or get the book, what's the best way of going about that?
So I'm on social media I've got is Twitter. So that's SammyH_93. As I say, I'm starting to put out more content through that stream. So again, if you're interested in the technical tactical stuff, you know, start looking at that. I did over this season particularly, I've started to put in a lot more of my own analytical clips on there, so people can see how kind of the analysis process either works. But unfortunately, there's a lot of copyright issues. So I'm basically trying to convert lots of footage into different ways of learning and stuff. So that is that's the one way. As I said, keep an eye on for the kind of this potential YouTube partnership that might start in the next couple of months, which again will be advertised out through the Twitter. And then in terms of an email, I've got footballinapandemic@gmail.com. Which I've had quite a few messages, certainly when the book was released, where either people are reading it and want a bit more insight into it, or maybe don't quite understand what I've tried to get across or whatever. So I've had a lot of feedback from that. So that's the kind of go-to email for that. And I also have that as the email for kind of if there's coaching advice, or people just want to chat about the game in general, or coaching or analysis or tactics or whatever, even if it's got nothing to do with the book. You know, feel free to find me an email, and I say it's footballinapandemic@gmail.com. I check that a couple of times a week, so I'm always open for discussion and help. Like I've said, I've had for so many people across the years that it's only right that I do the same.
Amen. Sam, thank you so much. We'll put the links in our show notes anyway to the Twitter handle, the email, and also the book. Thanks so much for your time. You were kind enough to accept our request to come on the podcast pretty quickly. So you're already giving things back already from, you know, that you had in your journey. So thank you for that. If you'll come back on at some point and talk about either the YouTube stuff or the next book, if there is one, and whatever else you're doing, that'd be great. Would you be open for that?
Yeah, definitely, mate. Yeah, it's been, when you said it was an hour and a half, I can't believe that's gone so quickly.
It goes so quick, doesn't it? But yeah. You've been brilliant. Thanks. Thanks so much. I really, really appreciate it. Look, best of whatever it is you're doing. Great work at Villa. Keep it up. Thank you for putting the book out there. And I look forward to the next episode talking about whatever it is you've got coming up next.
Top man. Cheers, Scott.
This episode was brought to you in association with our friends at Soccer Coach Weekly. Established since 2006, Soccer Coach Weekly is a leading source of inspiration and advice for all grassroots coaches. Join thousands of youth soccer coaches just like you, saving time and effort in their goal of having the most effective, enjoyable and successful coaching journey for them and their players. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode.